Live from the Valley of the Sun, sharing the news unedited, untainted, and unscreened. The real news you'll never hear on Fox, CNN, or NBC. Serious issues affecting all fellow Americans and the world. The man whose website is monitored by more feds than Osama bin Laden. The man who truly is not ready to make nice. Here's Michael Herzog with The American Awakening.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, April 14th, 2009 edition of The American Awakening. I am your host, Michael Herzog. I'll be with you for the next 3 hours. Now, second hour I've got coming up, Professor Emeritus Jim Fetzer, who has penned an article here. It's just been released on Op-Ed News, and it's actually flying its way all over the Internet, regarding the Cheney assassination team. And title of the article, folks, is, Has Cheney Been Murdering Americans? Now, first hour, I have coming up. I'm supposed to have coming up a gentleman of whom I'm going to name in a moment. But I wanted to mention to you folks, I've posted a clip on my website, theamericanawakening.org, of Reverend Billy. Now, this is a clip of him being arrested in New York while citing his and our First Amendment rights. And folks, this man has been jailed more than 50 times on his journey to educate America through his unique ministry. And how unique it is, you shall soon learn here. Now, I've said many times on my show that they can't do this to us unless we let them. Who's us? We, the people. Unless we let them, they can't do it. They can't take our freedoms unless we let them. Now, one of the ways we let them is through consumerism. We've had our minds molded through the media to believe that our identities are based on what kind of car we drive or in how big of a house we reside or what kind of wardrobe we adorn. And it's all tailored by clever media sales campaigns. This attitude has caused corporatism to flourish, money for lobbyist influence in Washington, causing politicians to vote for ridiculous and sometimes draconian legislation assisting to handcuff our freedoms. It's part of why there are sweatshops in places like Vietnam, China, Malaysia, exploiting the labor of their own people for our obnoxious consumer gluttony. And it's gotten so bad, folks, that even in the aftermath of 9/11, President George Bush told the American people to heal by going shopping. Well, now here's a man that's doing something about it, and there's really only one way to introduce him. His website is reverendbilly.com. It's R-E-V-Billy.com. His church is the Church of Stop Shopping, believe it or not. If you just Google Reverend Billy Talen, T-A-L-E-N, watch what happens, folks. This guy's been on mainstream TV from coast to coast. He's made a documentary called What Would Jesus Buy? And I have to tell you that what I'm going to do here, my board operator's been trying to get in touch with him from the telephone numbers that they gave us, and evidently there's no answer. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to just direct you to go into Google.com and to just Google Reverend Billy Talen. And there's a whole mess of video clips on him. Evidently, there must have been some emergency or something. My board op has not been able to get a hold of him. We've got two different numbers for him, and we're not able to raise him. So if my board operator, Colin, if you can get a hold of him, that's fine. Let me know. You might try for the next few minutes. If you can't get a hold of him, that's okay, because he was only going to be up for the first hour. And what I will do here is I will preface my interview. The second and third hour, I've got Professor Emeritus James Fetzer coming up. And also on my website, folks, I've posted this article in its entirety, and I'm going to share this article with you. It's an explicitly written article by Jim, and I'm going to go through it with you. Now, if by chance Colin does get hold of Reverend Talen, then I will cut this short. But in the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and share this article with you. And I would say, Colin, just give him a couple more tries. Evidently, there must have been some emergency come up or something. So it's not that big a deal. I can always reschedule him. Anyway, now this is posted right now on my website, theamericanawakening.org, folks. It's also posted on Op-Ed News. It's making its rounds on the Internet. It's a very eloquently written article by Jim Fetzer. The stunning revelation from our nation's premier investigative reporter, Seymour Hersh, that Vice President Dick Cheney was running an executive assassination ring directly under his control and outside of the normal chain of command, has raised the specter that the Vice President of the United States may have been murdering Americans. Now, Jim says, as a scholar who has invested a considerable effort in the investigation of the death of U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone, this comes as no surprise. He says, I and other experts with whom I've collaborated long since concluded that the crash that took his life and those of his wife, his daughter, his three aides, and two pilots was brought about deliberately, where Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Karl Rove are the principal suspects. Now, other cases in which assassination appears all too probably include those of NFL star Pat Tillman, of which I commented on the other day on my program, and also, folks, 9/11 activist, one of the Jersey girls, Beverly Eckert. Now, I'm going to pause here for a moment and say, Colin, go ahead and try to get a hold of Jim Fetzer right now, and forget about Reverend Talon, and see if we can pull him up right now, and we'll go into this. In the meantime, I'll continue with this. According to Paul Joseph Watson, the Joint Special Operations Command, the JSOC, did not originate Cheney, but was founded in 1980, which suggests that it may have been initiated by our then-president, George H.W. Bush, a former director of the CIA. Now, it consists primarily of Delta Force soldiers and SEALs who are stationed at Pope Air Force Base and at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And according to Watson, this assassination unit is still active under President Obama. The very existence of an operation of this kind raises questions of the utmost seriousness about democracy in America. What has become of this country when the expression of your political convictions and the pursuit of what you think best for this nation runs the risk, folks, of bringing about your termination? When our elected officials like Hitler and Stalin have the power to decide whether we live or die, depending on their whims, this country has ceased to be the home of the brave and the land of the free. Now, the story broke on the Minnesota Post-com, and that was back on March 11th of this year, when Eric Black wrote of a great conversations, even at the University of Minnesota, where during the question and answer session, Seymour Hersh reported not only that the CIA has been deeply involved in domestic activities against people they thought to be the enemies of the state, but that a special unit of our military called the JSOC was set up independently of the normal chain of command, reporting only to the vice president and to neither the Joint Chiefs or even the Secretary of Defense. Now, Congress has no oversight in it. It's an executive assassination ring, essentially, and it's been going on and on and on. And under President Bush's authority, they've been going into countries, not talking to the ambassador or the CIA station chief, and finding people on a list and executing them and then leaving. That's been going on in the name, folks, of all of us. If the only targets were foreign terrorists who were threatening to attack the United States, of course, many Americans might be sympathetic and even forgiving. But after publishing 10 news columns, co-authoring a book, and following up with an expert in extending the scope of the research about the death of Senator Paul Wellstone, it would not surprise me whatsoever that Dick Cheney deployed one of those JSOC teams to bring about Paul Wellstone's death. Now, the crucial consideration in evaluating alternative hypotheses in cases like these, just accident or assassination, is calculating the probability of the evidence on the assumption that each of them is true and comparing their values. Now, these are known as likelihood measures in evidential support, where the hypothesis that confers the highest probability on the evidence qualifies as the preferable hypothesis. Now, when the available evidence settles down, that is, points in the same direction, then the preferable hypothesis is also acceptable as true in the tentative and fallible fashion of science. Now, let's go back here again, and I've had Jim on my show. I don't think I've had him on this network, but in the death of, and he's penned some very, very eloquent articles regarding the death of Senator Wellstone. But he says in here, on as far as Wellstone is concerned, the plane crash that took the life of Wellstone occurred on October 25th, 2002, just 10 days before the election that pitted him against former St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman. And it is widely known in Washington that the Bush leadership had targeted Wellstone for elimination, although most would have assumed that was politically speaking rather than literally. One of the first to raise alarms was Michael Nyman, a professor at Buffalo State College, who enumerated reasons why they wanted to get rid of him. In an article, was Paul Wellstone murdered? And this is back in October of 2002. He explained that Wellstone was the only progressive in the United States Senate and an outspoken critic of the Bush administration. No one knew of Cheney's assassination unit, but the circumstances of his death raised suspicions on their own. Control of Congress hung in the balance, and since Jim Jeffords, a Republican from Vermont, had left the Republican Party and become an independent, there were 50 Democrats and 49 Republicans. So him being reelected was crucial to that fine line you draw of having a majority in the Senate for Republicans and Democrats, folks. We'll be back after the break. Michael Herzog, American Awakening. I'll continue with this and probably have Jim Fetzer up shortly. Be back in three.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.
All right, folks, we're back with the American Awakening. Michael Herzog, your host. And before the break, I was sharing with you part of this article, a very stellar article that Jim Fetzer has penned, Professor Emeritus from University of Minnesota, and the title of the article has Cheney been murdering Americans? And Jim has been gracious enough. I had a guest first hour that for some reason we have not been able to get a hold of. Jim has been gracious enough to come on earlier and discuss this article. And I'm so happy to have you here, Jim, today, and I have to congratulate you. This is a very, very well thought out, very critical, analytical article, and I'm always fascinated by your work, sir.
Well, I appreciate it, Mike. It's great to be back on with you. The article is getting a terrific reception for the last couple of days. It's been the most popular item on Op-Ed News.
Well, I can see why, because you've done just a stellar job of outlining this. And as you know, as critical thinkers, Jim, as you know, as an investigator, we have to connect the dots here. And of course, you know, the water is running in the opposite direction of trying to ever get an indictment against any of these thugs. But the bottom line is, when you connect the dots, there's an overwhelming consensus that there's just too many dots connected to make a very clear picture of what's going on here. So, what I'd like for you to do, let's just start off at the beginning, you know, because it's not new news that Seymour Hersh had come out with a stunning revelation about Dick Cheney's executive assassination ring. And it brings to mind, Jim, way back, and I don't know what it was, 2 or 3 years ago, I think there was a question posed to Dick Cheney, or they were asking him for some documentation, and he had said something. He had come away with the position that he was above the executive office of the vice presidency. Do you remember that? Do you remember him saying something like that?
Oh, I sure do, Mike. I mean, his arrogance is, unimaginable. I've never known of any public servant who thought he was even above the Congress, the judiciary, even the executive. It's unimaginable.
Well, and in light of that, this is what, when I started reading this, this is what came to mind with me. The hubris and the arrogance of this man is just untenable. But, of course, it extends beyond him. It's also the rest of that particular administration. And we see now, Jim, that, up till a couple of months ago, I believe, wasn't even that long ago, that Senator Leahy and Senator Whitehouse were talking about, and they were dancing around talking about the possibility of an investigation into the torture crimes of this administration, yet they have since backed off and said, well, you know, because of the economic turmoil that we're going through right now, we've kind of put that on the back burner. No, I believe it's because, and you correct me if you think you have a differing opinion, I believe it's because they realized that there would be too much complicity and too many of the Democrats would be exposed as well. Do you concur with that?
Over 9/11?
No, over the Senate the possibility of torture investigations.
Oh, the torture investigations. Well, that's a great suggestion, Mike. I'm sorry that I was distracted momentarily. I'm kind of shocked. I mean, this is truly disillusioning to me that Obama isn't doing a better job of cleaning house. I mean, he should be moving to repeal the Patriot Act. He should be getting rid of the Military Commissions Act. He should be absolutely opposed to surveillance of Americans. And he should be cleaning house with the Justice Department and all this torture stuff. Absolutely, there should be hearings held on it. I mean, there's a host of issues if we don't clean up the mess that's left behind, it's going to continue to contaminate the present administration, and he seems not to appreciate that.
Well, Jim, as long as we're on that topic, and I want to touch on this because this subject has come up before, you know, regarding Obama, and I know what your views are on Obama, but I'm sitting here looking at this. It was news that I didn't report yesterday. I didn't have time. But the title of this is "The Obama Administration Quietly Expands Bush's Legal Defense of the Wiretapping Program." And to me, you know, it was illegal to begin with, and they made it, you know, retroactive immunity for these communications companies. And to me, Obama is involved in this. His complicity makes him a felon for doing this. He should.
I'm coming around on this. I mean, I've been a very staunch supporter of Obama, but the fact that he has taken actions like what you're describing, and the fact that he hasn't moved strongly to repeal the Patriot Act, he hasn't abolished the Military Commissions Act, he hasn't taken stronger steps about surveillance, he's expanding the war into Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is all extremely, even profoundly troubling. So I've got to tell you, I'm now incredibly concerned about where things stand.
Well, okay, I have to tell you that I'm happy you're starting to come around on that, because some of the evidence that I've uncovered about what this man has been doing that does not get reported mainstream media, it sends shivers up my spine, Jim. But that being said, let's not get off topic with that too much, okay? I wanted to get back to this,
right?
Because you had made some very eloquent points in your article regarding you know, this assassination team, but also how it possibly could tie in, and I want to preface it by saying possibly, this is not conclusive, but we're just connecting the dots here, folks, and Jim is very good at doing that. We're also talking about how it, you know, relates to the late Senator Paul Wellstone, which we'll go into a little bit more of, and NFL star Pat Tillman and 9/11 activist, one of the Jersey Girls, Beverly Eckert. Okay, now, so I'll give you the floor. You penned the article, Jim. Which one, where would you like to start with this? Which one would you like to concentrate
on
first?
Well, the Wellstone case is the one that I have studied most extensively and therefore, you know, can assure you without any hesitation whatsoever that it was an assassination, and that Cheney, Rove, and Rumsfeld appear to have been the principals here. I think it was a small-scale conspiracy. It could have been as simple a matter as a director of charter aviation making a phone call to Dick Cheney and telling him Wellstone was going to be on the plane, Cheney conferring with Rove and Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld making a phone call to Raytheon, which owns Beechcraft, which manufactures the aircraft, but also has patents on several directed energy weapons, to find out what it would take to bring the plane down. And then they appear to have manipulated the GPS system, Mike. This is something that's really quite stunning, but the global positioning satellite system is all under military control. This was the last piece of the puzzle for me to sort out when a pilot who'd been flying east, the Wellstone plane had been flying west, told me how he had come out of the clouds and his GPS degrade light had come on, and neither he nor his co-pilot had ever seen that happen before. And when they came out of the clouds, they found themselves south of their destination by a couple of miles, and the same thing was happening with the Wellstone plane going west, that they were south by a couple of miles. And yet, if you were simply following your GPS, you would have thought you were right on target. And get this, it really sent shivers up my spine when he told me that he had taxied up to the terminal at the Waukegan Airport at 10:22, which was just the time that the Wellstone crash took place.
Right, and we also have other incidents of which you might want to expound on as well, where there were reports of cell phones that were malfunctioning, garage doors that were opening in the neighborhood without anybody hitting their little automatic garage door openers, things of that nature. Just a lot of, and here again, folks, all we're trying to do here is just connect dots. And another interesting snippet that you put in here, Wolf Blitzer, of course, attributed the crash to freezing rain and heavy snow, and everybody in the vicinity knew that that wasn't true. So what's up with that? I mean, you know, the mainstream parrots, or they're being parroted. They're just being told what to say and what to report. They're just reading off a teleprompter. They're not giving any critical thought to it whatsoever. But there are so many anomalies in this crash that when you did the investigation of it yourself after, you know, extensive research and the witnesses you talked to and so forth, I mean, it was pretty conclusive. Would you say it was 95%, 100% conclusive, 99% that
it's completely beyond a reasonable doubt because no alternative explanation is reasonable. But let me just mention some of the key points, you know. And the point you're making about the weather is really got to do with disinformation, creating a false first impression. That first impression tends to stick. We were told about Wellstone, it was the freezing rain and snow. We were told about Pat Tillman, that it was a firefight. We were told
okay,
about...
Jim, let me stop you. We got to take a break. Hold that thought, and then let's reiterate it when we get back. Michael Herzog, The American Awakening, with my special guest, Jim Fetzer. We'll be back in 3 minutes, and we'll cover more of this, folks. Stick with us. More to come.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place.
All right, folks, we're back with The American Awakening. My special guest, Professor Emeritus James Fetzer. And before the break, Jim, you were elaborating on some of the anomalies regarding the Wellstone crash. So go ahead and continue, my friend.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I just thought I'd mention to the audience that there's an awful lot about this. I wrote 10 columns for an alternative newspaper in Duluth, Minnesota, when I first investigated this. You can find all 10 of those columns on my public issues website at assassinationscience.com. Also, I then use those as the basis to co-author a book about it entitled American Assassination with Don Four Arrows Jacobs, a Native American scholar from Northern Arizona University. And when we announced the publication of the book, exactly 2 years after the event at the National Press Club, I presented one verbal statement and one written statement, and copies of both are found there. And then subsequently, I invited a PhD in electromagnetism, John Costella, whom I knew from research on JFK, and flew him to come to the United States and conduct research with me to confirm my hypothesis that this had been a directed energy weapon. And we were tramping around out in the boonies there where the plane had gone down at 35 below zero weather, Mike, picking up little pieces of the plane. And we would eventually go through some 2,500 pages of documents and reports on which the NST official report, which only ran about 60 pages, was purportedly based. And John made a rather stunning revelation, a discovery about a meteorological phenomenon that was very peculiar that the weathermen couldn't explain, which is directly related to our theory of the causation of the crash because of the level of the ice in the clouds, where the clouds would be laden with ice right above the crash site. They were full of water instead, which is completely inexplicable in terms of the crash, even though there was an intense fire that burned for 7 hours after the plane crashed that the firemen couldn't extinguish. The heat from fire falls off very rapidly in relation to distance, and it couldn't possibly have caused the clouds to melt. But along with the odd cell phone call to which you alluded, which was taking place right about the same time as the plane crash and in the immediate vicinity, and garage doors opening unexpectedly, we have this peculiarity in the atmosphere that would be a predictable consequence of the use of a directed energy weapon. Now, these devices, Mike, can take out all the electronics in a plane. They can take out the navigational system. They can take out its communication system. This plane was equipped with a loud stall warning device. I'm sure that would have been neutralized. Perhaps most important, the surge of electricity can flip these switches that control the pitch of the props. One of the oddities of the crash, and it was sent out for independent verification, was that the props were on idle. And indeed, it would have been the case that this surge of electricity would have caused the solenoids to switch the props onto idle, which, of course, would have left the plane basically with no forward thrust, so that it would have come down rather rapidly where the pilots had no control. In fact, the oddities of the crash include the fact that they didn't issue any distress warning. I mean, you had two pilots. It actually, that plane, a King Air A-100, only required one, but they had two pilots. According to the NTSB, the plane crashed because they neglected their altitude. But if you neglect your altitude, you know, or your airspeed, you're going to neglect your altitude as well, and, of course, your azimuth, the direction you're flying, the idea that, you know, one pilot would neglect his airspeed is, you know, just ridiculous, because this is like the most important point you're taught when you learn to fly a plane. So suppose we assumed, which is a gross exaggeration, this might happen one time in 100, and treat it as independent events, that one time in 100 you'd lose track of your altitude, one time in 100 you'd lose track of your azimuth. You're already up to one in a million for one pilot, and then we have two, so both of them would have had to have lost track of their airspeed, their altitude, and their azimuth, according to the official account. And then they have this loud stall warning device. I mean, the improbability is one in a million times one in a million times whatever it is, the improbability of them not paying attention to the loud stall warning device. And get this, Mike. The NTSB, in the course of its investigation, took pilots from the same charter aviation, took them down to Florida where there was a simulator. It actually had a slightly weaker engine than a King Air A100. But they gave the pilots the same flight conditions and flight plan, and had them fly abnormally slowly, and they still couldn't get the plane to crash. Which means the NTSB's,
well, I'll tell you,
the NTSB's own evidence contradicted its conclusions.
Well, in interjecting here, as a pilot, Jim, first of all, when you're on an approach, an instrument approach, which is what they were on, those particular gauges that you just mentioned are the pilots, that they're looking at those gauges. They're looking at those gauges almost regularly. When they're on an instrument approach. So what I can only speculate here, but I would have a tendency to believe that they were more concerned with trying to figure out why those props had gone to idle speed, because that would just totally obliterate their forward motion, and it wouldn't take more than several seconds at maximum to bring them to a stall. Now, I wanted to mention, Jim, you were talking about the ice crystals, and there weren't any in specific cloud formations there, and I wanted to ask you about this directed energy weapon. Is this something that's coming from a satellite, an airplane? I mean, what would you speculate on?
Oh, no, I think it was land-based. I believe it was there was a small van. A van departed the area immediately after the crash, and we suspect that the culprits were there. It would just have taken a couple of men in a van who had this weapon that they could direct up. The key part, Mike, was getting it into the kill zone. Once you got the plane to the kill zone, taking it out, you're going to obliterate all the electronics on the plane simultaneously, so they just wouldn't be in control. They wouldn't be able to issue a distress call. They couldn't really navigate much. I think they heroically tried to bring the plane down into an area of softwood trees to cushion it, but it was a swampy area. It was rather isolated, and the wings broke off as it crashed through the trees, and the tail too, and then the fuselage burst into this intense fire. They weren't able to even discover the bodies until the next day, when they were sifting through the charcoal and they found, the bodies, looking for the cockpit voice recorder. Get this, Mike. If anyone wants to see photographs of the crash scene, go to assassinationscience.com and scroll down to the article I co-authored with John Costella, which is entitled "The NTSB Failed Wellstone," and you'll find six photographs of the crash scene. And you're not going to believe how thoroughly this fuselage was destroyed. It was turned into charcoal.
Okay, so from a van, this directed energy weapon would have been pointed at the airplane, which would explain why, because, see, I was kind of looking at it from above. It would explain why when they hit the airplane, obviously the beam or the ray or whatever it was would go right on through the clouds, and it would melt the ice crystals.
Right, that's right. That's right. Now, in the case of this Beverly Eckert thing, I'm rather suspicious that it was done with a satellite-mounted weapon. You know, I know Bob Bowman personally. This is a guy who was a former Air Force hero pilot, flew 110 combat missions. He was also with a PhD in nuclear engineering from Caltech. He ran the Star Wars research program under Presidents Carter and Ford. And I had him on my show as a guest years ago, and I was pressing him about the militarization of space, you know, whether it was going to be, this program wasn't for offensive purposes rather than defensive. For whatever reason, he was evasive with me, but about 6 months later, he acknowledged candidly that the program had always been offensive and that was simply marketing to the American people to describe it as a defensive system. So that's
so
that
what we're speaking,
the militarization of, you know, and these weapons have been in development in 1969. We have a turning point in 1979. We have a Lieutenant General reporting to Congress in 89. I mean, they've been a very long time in development, and there are many different versions of them. In fact, in the course of my research on the Wellstone case, I turned up the Directed Energy Professional Society, which was meeting in Hawaii that year for like its eighth annual meeting, Mike. And these guys, you know, if you just read their program, you could see they were covering the bases about all the different kinds of weapons that they were manufacturing.
So what these weapons of which we speak have been up there, you know, for 20, 30 years. And it's been hidden from the American...
Something like that, you know, in some state or other, because some of them can be fired from the Earth, you know, and off of a mirror in space deflected down. In fact, that was happening already, I think, in around 1979. And it was when they had this very successful, because, of course, the lasers, see, they go in a straight line. So you can predict geometrically exactly where they're going to land. And it came down, you know, within a foot or two of the intended target. So I think at that point, they started to hush it all up because I knew they had something spectacular in the works.
Okay, well, and I don't want to get off topic. I want to cover a little bit more regarding this Wellstone thing because it all ties in, folks. This assassination team that Seymour Hersh has reported that Cheney evidently had, and we know that Cheney and Bush didn't like Paul Wellstone. He was actively against the war, and his seat in the Senate was a critical seat as far as the vote. We'll be back with Michael Herzog, The American Awakening, with my special guest, Jim Fetzer. We'll expound on this more when we get back. We're also going to cover Pat Tillman and Beverly Eckert. So stick around, folks. Don't go anywhere. It's going to be a very, very enlightening show. See you in three. Folks, we're back with The American Awakening. My special guest, Professor Emeritus James Fetzer, talking about this well-penned article, Has Cheney Been Murdering Americans? And, you know, before the break, I was talking about the critical seat, and Wellstone was running, I think it was like 50 to 49, and it would have swung the vote over to a majority for Wellstone's party. And interestingly enough, the party that was running against him, Norm Coleman, was Karl Rove's hand-picked candidate. And we all know that Karl Rove, they called Karl Rove Bush's brain, and all of these guys are a conglomeration of thieves here. So, you know, here there's more evidence fueled on here that indeed, you know, these guys didn't want Wellstone around. You want to comment on that, Jim?
That's quite right, Michael. That's quite right. And, in fact, a professor at Buffalo State College wrote a piece about was Wellstone murdered just based upon the political motivation they would have had to take him out, even though at the time he had no awareness that there would be any actual physical or other indications that, in fact, it had been a deliberate takeout. I might mention that if anyone wants to see the piece, you may have already offered this direction. But if they just put in, has Cheney been murdering Americans, onto Google, they'll come to the article on Op-Ed News. And if they scroll down, they'll find there at least 20 comments about the paper, some of which are extremely interesting. One commentator adding about 20 additional cases where he suspects something like this may have taken place. And Michael, too, I don't know if you're aware, but one of Cheney's former aides has confirmed that Hersh's account of the executive assassination ring is true. He even used the phrase, certainly true. His name is John Hanna, and he was interviewed on CNN, and he confirmed that, in fact, they were doing this. He wasn't talking about murdering Americans, of course, but going into foreign countries where the ambassador and the military commanders were unaware that they were operating in the vicinity and taking people out. Is something they were doing as a more or less routine matter, is my impression.
Well, and another thing, and I want to reiterate here, because you mentioned this early on, Jim, Beechcraft is owned by Raytheon, who has patents for directed energy weapons. And as you depicted so eloquently in your article here, it would have been a simple matter of just a phone call from one of the directors at Charter Aviation to Dick Cheney telling him that Wellstone would be aboard, and that's all it would take.
That's right, to trigger off this simple sequence. I think it was a very small-scale conspiracy. I don't think it involved more than 10 persons who who actually knew what was going on, or at least their part of what was going on. You know, so Raytheon would be the perfect source to get information about how to take out the plane. Now, you were asking about some of the signs, you know, what that were tipping me off that something odd was going on here, and I mentioned that business about first impressions being so important, because that's the way in which propaganda or disinformation is moved through the mass media. They give you a first impression. I mean, there's a big story a friend of mine is telling me about today about the Columbine shooting, for example, that there's an expose now, and I think it's on Yahoo, but other sites too, that the whole story we were told about the Columbine shooting and the motives of these young men were all, you know, grossly misrepresented in the press. Well, certainly the facts about the Wellstone case were being grossly misrepresented. You mentioned Wolf Blitzer. I mean, those of us who were there in northern Minnesota knew it was a pretty typical day for winter weather. There was nothing specifically severe about it. There wasn't, freezing rain. There wasn't a heavy snowstorm. In fact, other planes, and this is also true in the case of the Beverly Eckert crash, other planes had come in and landed at that airport without any problem at all. And in fact, when Gary Oldman, the airport manager, realized that the Wellstone plane was overdue, he immediately hopped in his plane, took right off. There was no concern about the weather, flew around looking for the crash site, saw some white, bluish-white smoke in the distance, did not believe that was the crash site because the plane fuel would burn black. But in fact, he came back and discovered it was the plane site. An electrical fire will burn with a bluish-white smoke. So it looks as though, you know, something was going on there that was causing that smoke that had an electrical component, which also ties in with the use of a directed energy weapon to hit the plane with an enormous surge of energy. But we had this false report about how terrible the weather was. In fact, Wolf Blitzer on CNN, Michael, was interviewing his man on the scene in the vicinity in Minnesota, who was saying, well, they'd closed the airport. And Blitzer was playing it like that was explanatory. He said, well, you know, they got this terrible weather, there's snow, there's freezing rain, and they closed the airport. That tells you all you need to know. But in fact, it's perfectly standard operating procedure when you have a plane crash that you close the airport, because for all you know, it may have been something about the airport that caused a crash. You don't want to allow other planes to crash, so you close the airport. It had nothing to do with the weather. In fact, you mentioned you yourself are a pilot, Michael. Well, there was a weatherman, an anchor, actually, in Duluth by the name of Denny Anderson, who is also a pilot and who had flown into the Eveleth, Virginia airport. And everyone I've ever talked to about it tells me it's a very user-friendly airport, okay? It's not an intimidating approach. It's very easy access. And he was constantly correcting the reports that were coming out about the exaggerated weather. So it was a very strange day if you were in Duluth that you'd be hearing these reports about the crash, and here you got the anchor man at your local TV station who's correcting what the national press is reporting.
Then
of course, turns out to be the FBI was on the scene almost immediately. It was really quite stupefying. I mean, you got this plane crash. It actually occurs at 10:22, but Gary Oldman, the airport assistant manager, doesn't locate the crash scene until 11. He comes back down and picks up the local fire chief so they can figure out what way they can get into the swampy wooded area best, because it's not very accessible. And yet, When Rick Wolberg, who was the county sheriff for St. Louis County, this huge county in northern Minnesota that extends right up to Canada, arrived on the scene at 1:30, he saw men he knew personally from the rapid response team of the FBI based in St. Paul. And he asked them, he says, how long have you been here? And they told him they had been there since noon. Well, I mean, Gary Oldman didn't call up the FBI and say, we got a plane crash out here. I mean, how would the FBI have known? In order to be there by noon, Michael, and this is one of the most troubling aspects to me, I did a backward calculation, and the publisher of this little newspaper, which is called the Reader, was so concerned that I get it right that he kept pressing me to reduce the amount of time it would have taken him to get to the airport, the amount of time it would have taken him to get in the air, the amount of time it would have taken him to fly to Duluth, the amount of time it would have taken him to rent a car, amount of time it would have taken him to drive up to Eveleth, Virginia, and so forth, to be there by noon. And there was no way you could cut it that didn't mean that they had could take off later than 9:30 in the morning. But that just happens to be the same time the senator's plane was taking off, Michael. So how did the FBI know that they should be in the Eveleth, Virginia vicinity because of a plane crash that hadn't yet occurred. But this was also equally damning, in my opinion. Namely, an FBI spokesman by the name of McCabe would announce that evening that there were no signs of terrorist involvement. No signs of terrorist involvement? I mean, they didn't even know the cause of the crash. How can you know there are no signs of terrorist involvement if you don't know not only the cause of the crash, but who is responsible for the cause of the crash and their political motivation? I mean, to say there are no signs of terrorist involvement is fantastic. The FBI could not have possibly known at that point in time, when no investigation, no causation had been determined, that there were no signs of terrorist involvement. So that, to me, was extremely suspicious.
Jim, let me stop you here. The reason he said there was no sign of terrorist activity is because he knew that Cheney pulled the trigger and that Cheney's not a terrorist in his mind. Come on, Jim. So that's how he came out with that statement. Let me interject something here. I mean, it's downright laughable. It's downright laughable. But what else is laughable is that particular airplane, they're talking about ice and, oh, the weather and it's terrible and the ice crystals and so forth and the dew point and blah, blah, blah. You know what? The plane had de-icers. Beverly Eckert's plane had de-icers. It was a couple plane. My little twin aero commander had de-icers. I was not concerned about flying into that kind of weather because all I have to do is flip a switch and the ice is gone. So give me a break here. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's got these expandable, components on the front wing that break off the ice. I mean,
it's an icing boot.
Yeah, boots. The icing boots. I mean, it's ridiculous. And both of these cases are very similar in the following respect. The Beverly Eckert plane was also a superb aircraft. It was quite a new one called the Bombardier. And I guess it could handle 74 passengers. There were 50 on board, including the pilots, and there were two pilots there as well. But it's a simply excellent aircraft, just as the Air King A100 is an excellent aircraft. The A100 is like the Rolls-Royce of small planes, practically flies itself. Two pilots in both cases, no distress call either time. Allegations of ice buildup, but the Bombardier, just like the King Air A100, had very sophisticated de-icing equipment. In fact, what really happened, the webmaster went through the transcript, a transcript of some of the final transmissions they had from the plane before disaster hit. This is now in relation to the Buffalo crash. And he found that they were actually reporting that they had no indication on their equipment that they were having any trouble with icing. And yet the mass media, even the New York Times, was reporting in big, big stories that this was a weather-related crash, that the ice had built up and they hadn't been able to cope with it.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, Jim. We've got a top-of-the-hour break coming up, and we've got a six-minute news break here, Jim. So I want you to relax, get a cup of coffee, whatever you need to do. We'll be back in about 6 minutes after the hour, and we'll finish up on Wellstone. Remember, this all ties into the Cheney assassination team, folks, with this article, brilliant article penned by Jim Fetzer, Has Cheney Been Murdering Americans? Next hour, we're going to get into Beverly Eckert, her airplane, who she was and what she did. And in the third hour, we're going to end up this program talking about Pat Tillman. So stick around, call your friends and neighbors. This is a lot of excellent information, folks. Be back in 6 minutes. Stay tuned for news.
They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting.